Can you tell me a little bit about agro-industrial? Is that how you say it?
Agro-industrial, yeah. It's the record we're recording right now, and I believe it's going to be streeting, as the kids call it, in March of 2010. And, in fact, I'm driving right now to go rehearse and some new songs that we're writing for the record right now, driving to Nashville. So, collaborating with Dwayne Dennison, who's the new guitar player, and the Jack Hickers, who's also in the Jesus Lizard, band that was pretty big for a while there about 10 years ago. And they're actually reforming for a reunion tour this year. And so we're looking forward to recording a new record with some more of industrial or that agro-industrial flavor. What that means is it's kind of the sounds of rural industry sort of like captured in the music, just like Johnny Cash played Train Rhythms, that was sort of a pre-industrial style of music. We'd like to expand upon that concept of trying to capture organic, rustic rhythms and textures to help kind of flesh out the more countryside of the Shack Shakers and more kind of rural influences that we already have in the music.
How far are you in the recording?
Well, we've got about most of the record recorded. We decided we needed a few more other time signatures, grooves, sounds that were lacking, and we thought maybe we could flesh it out a little bit more if we went in and wrote a few more songs, just to keep it a well-rounded quality, and make sure there wasn't anything we left out. We're just kind of dotting all our I's and crossing our T's right now.
And how's this different from the Ten Show trilogy?
For one, we have a solid lineup, and everyone is sort of in the writing process this time around. Before it was sort of a carnival theme or a tent show theme, a lot more polka and Latin flavors and the old stuff that we were touching on, give it that kind of gypsy circus feel. This time around, it's a lot more again, the rustic, agrarian, and kind of edgier, I think, more cinematic and engrossing. Just because, for one reason, the musicianship has gotten so much better, and just because the personnel of the band has solidified. So we're just anxious to kind of capture that, and try to have it come off as live and as immediate as possible.
What's Dwayne brought to the band in terms of? I know he's a pretty well-known guitar player. How has he changed the sound? What has he contributed?
Well, he has a knack for sorts of an aggressive quality, bringing a kind of an aggressive attack to the music. Also, he's not just his chops, but his ideas are a lot more engrossing and, again, cinematic. And he's not just some rock and roll guitar player crunching through a bunch of chords. He's a writer also. So he brings these sorts of industrial rhythmic patterns into the mix. And of course, I'm more like the roots music guy, the country, the blues aficionado in the band. So when we combine the two, that's where you get the agricultural beating industrial sound. So that collision course there, just in our writing. So it's we had to make up a new term to describe it.
And that's agro-industrial?
That is, yes. Uh-huh.
You talk about the way you describe it, you would think that you were almost playing traditional music, and of course you're not, or at least you're not a lot of the time. You seem to be to straddle a lot traditional and contemporary influences. How is that a challenge for you as a band to be able to balance those things and to make everybody keep everybody happy in that context?
It, the music is pretty traditional. I think if you track down all of our songs, still be covered by a bluegrass band, pretty faithful. I mean, is still there. That sort of organic accessibility, the melodic qualities are all still there. We just give it sort of an edgier, louder texture and an edgier texture and a louder presentation than most roots music bands. But we're still playing basically acoustic instruments, so a hollow body guitar, an upright bass, a drum kit, and a harmonica. You know, that's still what we consist of, and it's just that we're amplified, and that we try not to fall for the cliches of the music of the rockabilly genre or the blues genre, psychobilly. We get pigeonholed in a lot of those, but we want to make sure that we never fall for any of the cliches and allow ourselves to be personally pigeonholed in our writing.
What's the stage show like these days?
Yeah, it's tight. It's still animated and propulsive. But again, I always try to stress that it's four frontmen in this band. You know, you could handicap yourself to just watch one member. Just randomly pick any one of us and watch for the whole show, and anyone, you know, you would be thoroughly entertained just doing that, by doing that. So we're it's a four ring circus, and it's no matter where you look, there's something going on, and it's I think it's a visual delight as well as a sonic experience too. So you know, we all want to always remember that we're song and dance men and entertainers as well as artistes.
And does that kind of go back to your background in visual art or your interest in visual art?
Yeah, well, I do have like a degree in art and all that, but I think just as like a fan of live music, I just would require of any band, and I do require of any band to entertain me, and I would want. So I want the same standards applied to me, you know, if I was the front man, you know. It's like, I think if you're, forget about that you're there for the audience, you know. If when you play selfishly, it's always instantly recognizable. You're either staring at your sandals or you're self-absorbed into your singer-songwriter, like, you know, twee. You know, it's always kind of like obvious when someone is singing more for themselves to be aggrandized or supposed to be a genius, you know. But we're there for the audience. We're there to sell beer. Ultimately, we're, you know, it's a ridiculous notion of strumming strings stretched across pieces of wood and blowing into little metal objects. It's ridiculous to think, I mean, to take that so seriously. And we want to always remember that we're there to entertain and, you know, and put a smile on the face of like hardworking people that are there to blow off steam, you know. And failing, you know, if you fail that, then you're failing rock and roll. That's what it's, you know, it's the bestial nature of rock and roll.
Now, you'll be playing here on the 4th of July. You have anything special planned for Independence Day?
No, just the usual sort of metaphorical fireworks, nothing actual, no fire play. Not since Great White have we ever played with fire on stage. So we learned our lesson along with all the other bands when the fire marshals descended upon live music venues across the country. So we're not going to risk it. We're just going to do our show as it is, and no frills, just lean, mean rock and roll.
Now, you mentioned that the Jesus Lizard was getting back together. Is Dwayne going to stick with Shack Shakers?
Yeah. Well, this is just a temporary reunion tour in celebration of like their 20-year anniversary of their first record release. So, they're not back together for good, and we have a lot of shows booked this year all the way up into next year. So we're who's in it for the long haul. We're already talking about management and labels and things for the, you know, we're talking long term. So, yeah, Dwayne's in it. He's the new guitar player, so.
This is the third guitar player, right?
We've had a million over the years, but yeah, the third one that most people know, we had Joe Buck, David Lee, and Dwayne Dennison, so Dwayne's probably the most accomplished and the most musical, and no slight to the other guys who brought their own qualities, but Dwayne definitely is a master, and he's classically trained on top of that. He's like the only classically trained, like, you know, hard rock, alternative rock and roll guitar hero I know of. So, and he's playing all this hillbilly music with us, so I don't know what he's thinking.
You mentioned you were thinking long term. What is the kind of the career arc for the band from this point forward? Do you have an idea of what you want to be doing and
yeah,
with whom you want to be doing it in terms of labels, in terms of
I think
business?
The wave of the future is kind of owning it yourself. I think that anyone with half a brain would realize, you know, these labels really are getting rich off the product we supply, and it's this endless recouping of their expenses that you never get a piece of the pie like you think you're going to get. And nowadays, you might as well own it yourself, and you can put those MP3s up online and sell them yourself. Now there are websites that allow you to do all kinds of things that we weren't able to, 5 years ago. So I think the wave of the future for a working band that's got, you know, that's wanting to make money and not just have it be some, you know, glamorous ego trip for a year and then burn out. If you're a musician and you know that's what you're going to do, you might as well be a self-employed in every single way that you can, because that's the way you're going to make your money. I mean, who was it? I think Manor Astro Man. They owned it all themselves, and they retired millionaires. Actually, you know, they never had a hit. You know, so it can be done. So it's just about how you look after your money, and you got to be smart about it. Really, now we're going to put out this record. We all have kind of little side projects we do musically or otherwise, art. We're all kind of like Renaissance men in a way, because we dabble in a lot of different things, but we meet and go out and tour as the Shack Shakers, and that's we're able to make a living and just kind of juggling these different aspects of our personality. So that's good enough for me, and we're making a living, so that's my Grammy Award.
Could you tell me a little bit about Seven Signs? Are you still promoting that? I know it's been out on DVD for about half a year now, right?
Yeah, we're still selling it very solidly, and we get about an order a day, which it's for a DVD. Again, there's a perfect example of where, you know, you can do it yourself. You can sell it online, and if you already sort of corner a certain market or a niche, you know, like we do with our Southern Gothic kind of following, then you can keep that money. And yeah, that's something that we're still promoting. I mean, every once in a while it'll show in a film festival. Last year was the big push that culminated with our showing it at Rain Dance, which is the UK's largest film festival, where the films are actually independent, not pretend independent like the Sundance Festival. Mm-hmm. That's really a front for a major label or major motion picture industries, faux independent movies. So, we're having we're still selling that. We sell it mostly now online and at the merch table at shows. And so anyone can get a copy of that. They can go to jdwilkes.com and order it. So,
mm-hmm. What was the origin of that for you?
What was the what?
The origin of the movie.
Well, originally it was kind of a counterpoint answer movie to Searching for the Wrong-Eyed Jesus, which was a BBC-produced film about the same sort of thing of Southern visionaries and musicians. And But it was it tried to be a dramatic piece. At the same time, it was attempting to be a documentary, which kind of lent it to sort of scripted moments that seemed to be lacking in authenticity, I thought. I blogged about it, made a big stink about it, sort of threw down the gauntlet and said that I would make my own movie, you know, if it killed me. And that's what I did, and I ended up like having a very public online sort of feud with the screenwriter for Searching for the Wrong Eye Jesus. Since then, I have befriended him, actually, and he actually has helped me out with a lot of pointers about promotions and marketing and the festival circuit. So, Steve Haysman is his name. So, yeah, I mean, it's still for sale. It's still out there. I think I accomplished what I set out to do, and we made an honest movie about folks that are genuine and authentic and uniquely Southern and uniquely philosophical and talented and worthy of celebration.
And did you? And it didn't kill you.
It did not kill me. No. Hello. It nearly did. It nearly did.
Did you have?
I won't go into that.
Did you have a background in filmmaking at all?
No, that's why it was so ballsy of me to make that such to blog so strongly about it and to challenge this guy. I had never done that, but I've done a lot of comic book kind of storyboarding and cartooning and visual. I'm trained in visual arts, and it's kind of the same sort of process, just a different medium as say painting or printmaking or live performance. Even, you know, it's just it's a different discipline. It's the same sort of discipline you need, but just a different medium.
How did you go about doing the documentary? Did you have an idea of who you wanted to talk to or what you wanted to?
Over the years of touring with the band and meeting people, there's those certain folks that I've met or happened to run across. I in the back of my mind, I just filed them away because I wanted to film them one day if I ever could do something like that, or I wanted to come back and photograph them, or, you know, and so that I just sort of kind of kept them in the back of my head, or there were places that I thought should be filmed or places that needed to be captured as B-roll at least. And so we just I just made a list of all those people, all those places I always wanted to do that with, and made a list and set it up and asked some buddies with cameras to go with me, and we just went methodically down the line and did our interviews, and then one thing would lead to another, and this person would know another person, or one of the filmmakers knew of a different person of a similar ilk that we could film, and it just kind of one thing led to another like that.
And how long did it take you?
It took me a couple of months cumulatively, if you were to put it all together, to film it, and then a year to whittle it down from just hacking away at it, you know, between tours. So, and I did that with an editor up in Chicago, and it was just kind of like asking my buddies to give me a hand at something, and they shared the vision and shared the interest, and were into it, into the idea selflessly, you know, because it wasn't done for any, there was no budget, and it was done all, you know, just out of love of the subject matter.
Were these things that you thought would be lost sooner or later, given the
right.
I think that the sprawl of cities that's happening around the country, or
right? Yeah, it's in danger. We've already pretty much lost it. Counterculture, pop culture, urban sprawl, all of these sort of modern forces have pretty much destroyed our indigenous culture and identity and language and mythology and music, all of those things that make us who we are, or were, made us who we were as Americans, as Southerners. And it's not really about the South. It's really about anywhere where that's just a microcosm that we set the movie within. It is a bigger picture that's happening worldwide of this globalization, the homogenization of cultures, and it's very uninteresting to me that the pop culture and the way things are happening in China and Japan and where they all kind of adapt this Americanized Western mentality and culture, and it's not it seems sad to lose something that they kind of grew up over thousands of years, and it takes thousands of years to create a culture and a civilization, but it can take just one generation to destroy it. It doesn't take any effort to knock over a house of cards, but it takes a while to build it up. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's what's happening now with the onslaught of technology and the contractors and urban sprawl and television and the internet. It's just too many forces at work to destroy what we, even Americans, had. Not just China, or some foreign third world nation.